Right, good afternoon. I hope you had a good weekend. I handed the first chunk of the homework, those which were there on Friday, I handed them back. In problem 30, to show that a lattice is distributive if and only if it doesn't contain one of these two forbidden lattices, a sublattice. There, in a lot of cases, I wrote a brief remark on the site which says something like, are you showing this? Are these really two different directions which you're showing? I mean, there is an if and only if you have to show if they contain a sublattice like this, they're not distributive, and if they're not distributive, they contain a sublattice like this. So the one that the first direction is relatively easy. If they contain such a sublattice, look at elements in there and you immediately see, okay, this can't be distributive because these lattices are not distributive. In the other direction, you assume that it is not distributive, and now you need to somehow show one of these two lattices exists in there. Okay, and then some of you made the argument, oh, let's look at all possible sublattices with five elements, and I look at what happens then. But why can you do this? Why is it enough to look at sublattices with five elements? Or that you said, or that some said, oh, we go through all sublattices of five elements and show that if these don't occur, it's fine. Well, that's not really a difference. This is, again, the same direction. So basically, what you would need to, or at least that's the only way how I can imagine proving it, is to say, okay, let's assume that distributivity fails. That means you have a situation where the distributive law does not hold. And that gives you some elements in your lattice where things go wrong. And you take these elements and associated meet and joins, and that give you five elements. Or that gives you the sublattice. And you look at how does it fail, and are things too large, are things too small, and that's how you fall in case. That gets you multiple cases, and that's how you get to these sublattices. So the main thing really just is be careful with an if and only if statement that you're really proving both directions. And it is easy if you show one direction and the other thing is what the contrapositive. So you show if A then B, and you show if not B then not A. That's the same thing, even if you draw the arrow in the other direction. Okay, that's basically the remark I have about the homework. Are there questions? No? So, what we did last time is we proved the marriage theorem, which is a statement of systems of distinct representatives. If you have subsets of some larger set, when can you choose representatives? Well, what you need is that any collection of k of the subsets, if their union contains at least k elements in total, then you can do so. Not necessarily uniquely. It can be unique in some situations, but it doesn't have to be. And the theorem just gives you existence. One can go and refine this and even give estimates about the number of possibilities of such systems of distinct representatives, but I wasn't planning to go there towards this counting. But so yeah, the criterion is if the union of any k set of or k collection collection of k subsets together contains at least k elements clearly necessary, then you can pick a system of distinct representatives. And in some way, the results, the way this theorem is used is often a little bit surprising, that something happens that you can say, oh, I can do this, I can fit things together in that way, it will always work, and it, I mean, it is not constructive in the sense of that it tells you immediately how to find it, but it is often situations where you initially might try to see, oh, can I prove this in some way constructively, and it looks completely hopeless to do constructively, and yeah, just this counting argument gives you the result. So we will have some examples of this in the homework, but I want to give you one example also here in class. And I mean, yes, you can. There is the baby type of examples. Here are some explicit sets. Find a set of distinct representatives. Since this is a graduate class, I'm not going to do this here. I trust that you're all able to do so if you want it, but if you find a lack of creativity in constructing a collection of subsets, let me know and I can point you to some. So, what I want to do is to prove a theorem by Birkhoff, which is a theorem about some class of matrices, an important class of matrices are permutation matrices. These are matrices which only have entries of 0 or 1 in every row and in every column contain exactly 1, 1. These are matrices which represent permutations of elements. And what Birkhoff's theorem says is in some way is certain that is another class of matrices can be interpreted as a generalization. So let me first give the definition. Let's say we have a matrix M with integer entries, and I want non-negative integer entries. Okay, so such a matrix is called doubly statistic if the following property holds, that every row and every column has the same sum. Has the same row / column sum, and even across rows and columns the sum should be the same. So for example, if I pick a 3x3 matrix, let's put a 2 here, 1, 1, 1, well, this is not very exciting, that matrix would be doubly statistic. Right? Row sum is 2, column sum is 2. Okay. And these matrices occur in quite a number of applications. So these are not just hypothetical objects. Okay. Now, what Birkhoff's theorem says, which is corollary, so this is Birkhoff's theorem. Take a doubly statistic matrix. So, if the matrix M with entries Mij is an N cross N matrix, if this is doubly statistic, well, or let me first ask, suppose we had a matrix which is doubly statistic, where row column sum is 1. What can we tell about that matrix? It's a permutation matrix, right? And what Birkhoff says is, if it's doubly statistic with row and column sum L, then M is the sum of L permutation matrices. Okay, that it's L permutation, I'll get to you in a moment. That it's L permutation matrices is not very surprising. That's basically the only way how you can achieve the row and column sum. But that you can write it as a sum of permutation matrices might initially be a bit surprising. Okay, Zach, you had a question.
Are these all square matrices?
Yes, n by n square, yes. If they're not square... Well, I mean, in some way, then the question is, what are permutation matrices? Yeah. Well, you could still say if it's not square, you can't have a 1 in 1 every row and every column. And if you, this example, it's not very hard to do, but if you just try this by trying out, if you try to describe an algorithm for doing this, it's not obvious why this would happen. Because you make some choices, and clearly not every choice is going to be successful. This is not something where you can use a greedy algorithm and you just say, I pick one field, I want a 1 here, and now I pick others. But things need to fit together nicely. Well, so let's prove this. So what I'm going to do is I define sets of row indices. Sets indexed by the rows, and the sets contain column indices. Column indices indexed by rows. So, what I define AI shall be the set of those J such that MIJ is strictly greater than 0. Yeah, so that just tells me what are the entries, in which column positions are the entries in the ith row which are not negative. Okay. So, now let's look at a k-tuple of indices. Of row indices. So, if I take a k-tuple of row indices and I sum over these rows over these k rows is k times L, right? The sum over every row is L. If I have k rows, the sum over these k rows is k times L. That's not very surprising. But now let's look at this as the column. Well, so I have my matrix here. I have identified k rows. Now let's look what happens if I would do this summation over the columns. Right? Every column can give me at most a contribution of L, because the total column sum is L. So if I just sum over some entries in the column, I can't get more than L. But to get to a total sum, I mean, the total sum has to be the same of KL, This means that there need to be at least k columns which have non-zero entries. Right? So this sum is this. Therefore, there need to be at least k columns that have non-zero entries in these k rows. Okay, and that's just a counting argument or adding argument, adding the entries this way or adding them this way gives me the same result. What does this mean for these indices of non-zero entries? That means that the union over indices in any index set, if I take these AIs, this is at least as big as the size of the index set, right? The index set, this is my K. I have an index set of K row indices. I said if I have K rows, the matrix must have non-zero entries then in at least K columns for these rows. These columns are given by the AIs, by the index sets AI. So the union over the AIs is simply the indices of the columns which have non-zero entries in these K rows. And we have seen it needs to be at least K. Well, that's the Hall condition. So we can find, so by Hall, we know there exists a system of disjoint representatives. Okay, so what is a system of distinct representatives in this case? Let's say we have xi for ai. So that means for every row I have picked a column xi. Right? That's a system of distinct representatives. And that means P, which is the matrix of the form which has Pij, where Pij is equal to 1 if j is equal to xi and 0 otherwise, is a permutation matrix. Okay. So I have a permutation matrix, and the rest now is routine. I take the permutation matrix and let's look at what happens if I take M minus P. Well, P had ones only in positions where the matrix M had strictly positive entries, right? So if I look at M minus P, I get a matrix which still will have non-negative entries, right? Because I only subtract this, the most I subtract is 1, and I subtract 1 from something which is at least 1. So I can never create negative entries this way. So, this is a matrix which still has non-negative integer entries. Yes?
What is big M?
Big M was the matrix I started with. The doubles. doubly statistic matrix, and there is a misprint in the notes where I call it A, okay. But because where I copied the theorem from, it was called A, and I realized no, the A's were the names of my sets. It's not good to call everything A, so yeah, that's why the matrix is now called M. So if I subtract that permutation matrix, I'm still end up with non-negative entries. Furthermore, I claim this matrix is doubly statistic, right? Because in every row and in every column, I've subtracted exactly one. So this is still doubly statistic. And now I just do induction over the row and column sum, over L. The base case L equals 1, then I have a permutation matrix. Otherwise, this is the reduction we need, and that proves the theorem. And so we get, admittedly, in a non-constructive way, we get with very little work this result, which I find somewhat surprising that it always works out nice. And just the caveat, really, it is not, it's just the existence statement. You can find such a set of representatives. You cannot expect, and we will have a homework problem about this, you cannot expect that you can grow such a system of representatives one by one. That you say you start with some sets, find a set of representatives, then go to the next set and add a new element. It can work in certain cases, or it depends if your choice is lucky, this works, but it is not guaranteed to work. And that's in some way why this is still probably why this looks like a hard problem. And it's really just an existence statement, but in many cases, this is good enough. Okay, yeah, so that's Hall's theorem. Before erasing things, or consequence from Hall's theorem, before erasing things, are there questions? Yeah, and I'll get to you in a second. Ethan?
So you've given a non-constructive proof of this. If you wanted to actually find the matrices, how would one go about doing that?
Probably you would have to do something which is what would be called a backtrack search. So what you would do is you would actually try to build it one by one, but you need to be prepared to say, oh, something might have gone wrong. I need to go back and revise my choices. And so you need to not just find one, but in some way have a process which then goes systematically to all of them before. Well, you say this number doesn't work, so let's try. What other number could I try? And it could go back multiple times, which makes it exponential in runtime. I don't know whether there is.
I mean, there's the naive brute force one. There are finitely many permutation matrices.
Yeah. Sure.
Points, so you can just look at all the collections.
But that's exponential. Yes, but that's
terrible.
That's exponential time, and I don't. I somehow suspect that you really can't do without that. That you can't fundamentally get away from this. From this bad case. So, to show that you can't get away, probably you would want to do something that you say, you pick a random permutation in the symmetric group and build a set of you don't want the AI, it's just that AI is the value of I under that permutation. You want to hide it somehow by having further points, but basically you want a condition that you would need to recover that permutation from something. And that the only way you really can make it is to pick that permutation. you know, this is rather vague in the description, but I'm pretty sure there isn't fundamental. I mean, in many practical cases you can, but I think the worst case might always be this permutation search. Okay, you also had a question.
Okay, so we're taking the columns, and then the representatives are the rows.
We're taking them for what?
The sets that we're representing are the sets.
Yes, so the representatives now are column indices.
Okay.
Right? And we have column indices which represent these sets AI, but the sets AI correspond to the rows. So what we have done is that if an element X represents the set AI, this is saying in the ith row pick column X. And by being distinct representative, we get the permutation matrix for free. Other questions? No? So, the next thing, and I mean, what will happen in this chapter is that, in part because what theorem follows from the previous one, the setup is not completely different. But on the other hand, it's not that you say, oh, this is the same thing as before. There's a little bit of change in there, but don't be surprised that things look similar. So in the next section we will look at two theorems from classical. Well, the first one actually is still about matrices, about an aspect of classical graph theory, aspects of matchings. So that is what section number section 2. These are Koenig's theorems named after Dinesh König. König, again, this is this weird Hungarian umlaut. Hungarian mathematician who wrote the first textbook about graph theory. And yeah, we stay initially, and then we have the topic of matchings. Well, what a matching is, I'll tell you in a little while. Initially, let's look at the situation, still at a problem which is phrased in terms of matrices. So, and I want to define a few terms which we basically just need for to state that theorem. So, let A be an M cross N matrix with entries from 0 and 1. So I have an M by N matrix whose entries are 0 or 1. A line of A is a row or a column. And I don't want to. Yeah, it can be either. A set of lines covers A if every one lies on one of these lines. It might lie on multiple, but lies on at least one of the lines. So, for example, pick some matrix here, 1 0 0 0. It's a 4x4 matrix. 1 0 1 0 1 0 0 1 0 0 1 1 1. So how could we cover this with lines? I could, for example, pick this line, and this, right? That would be a line cover. I'm not claiming that it is unique. You could do it differently. You could, for example, yes, yes, that will do. But then I have 4, and here I can actually cover with 3. Can I do it? Or is this actually the best I can?
3 is the best you can do.
Yeah, 3 is the best I can do. Can I do it differently with 3? That's what I'm wondering.
If you take the first 3 columns.
Oh yes.
No, then you're missing.
No. Then I'm missing this one here. Anyhow, there is no reason that it should be unique, and it's not hard to come up with an example where it is not unique. For example, if you take the identity matrix, you could cover it with 2 rows, with 2 rows or 2 columns, right? So it's not unique. Okay. So the second part of the definition is I will call 2 non-zero entries independent, 2 non-zero entries of A are independent. And that really is just a definition for the following theorem. It's just a definition which lives in this section, are called independent if they are not, if, oh, not just 2, any set, a set of non-zero entries of A is independent if no 2 of them lie on a common line. So, for example, let's pick that matrix, some independent set. I could pick this one, and I could pick this one, and I could pick this one. Right? No 2 of them lie on a common line. Okay. And the maximum number, maximum size of an independent set we call the term rank of A, just because it's slightly shorter to write. Okay. So, yeah, what do we expect to hold for these entities? What does the example show us?
The max size of the term rank is the same as the smallest number of lines.
Yes.
You cover.
Yes. Which is not, I mean, in some way this looks, conceptually it looks the same as Dilworth's theorem. There is a maximum and a minimum of dual things and they match up. They're just, the things are different, and so we can't just say this is a special case of that theorem. So the theorem this theorem is named after Koenig and Igarvari. Accent on there. And this says the minimum num size of a line cover lines, line cover equals the term ring. Okay. So in our example, we have term rank the max, the maximum size of an independent cover. Yeah, it's not hard to see that you can't have an independent cover of size 4 in this matrix. Right? Or is it? Well, in the worst case, one would run through all 24 permittances. An easy argument, why not? Well, in some way it will follow from the theorem with the max min, because one of the inclusions is obvious, or is pretty obvious. If I have k independent entries, I need at least k lines to cover, right? I need to cover each of them. No two lie on one line, so I need a separate line to cover each of them.
So,
and so since I have three independent, clearly I have three independent entries, so I need at least three lines with covering, but since I can cover with three lines, I cannot have more than three independent entries, because then if I had four, two of them would have to lie on the same line and then they wouldn't be independent. Okay, so this is a case where we indeed have a minimum line cover and maximum independence. So let's prove this, and what I'm going to prove is that Hall implies König Igarvari. So let's take a matrix which is a 0, 1 matrix, an M cross N matrix, and I denote by P the term rank. And by Q the size of a minimal line cover. So, I claim that clearly P is smaller or equal than Q. Right? That was the argument. If I have a line cover of size Q, I cannot have more than Q independent entries, because that line cover covers all non-zero entries. If I had more than Q independent ones, I would have to have at least two on the same line, which would contradict independence. So P smaller or equal than Q comes for free. So I need to show the other direction. I need to show that P is greater or equal than Q. So we have to show that P is greater or equal than Q. So what I now want to do, and I'm doing so to avoid, well, at some point I need to refer to indices of rows or indices of columns in the matrix. And I want to avoid a double indexing. I want to avoid that I'm saying I'm referring to the jth of my indexed rows and have some I index j as an index itself. And therefore, I will allow myself to permute the rows or the columns of the matrix. Right? If I permute the rows of the matrix, neither the size of a minimal line cover nor the size of a maximal independent set will change. It's just the indices change. Similarly for permuting columns. So, what I will do is, therefore, without loss of generality, permute the rows and columns of this matrix A so that it's A such that a minimal line cover, and I just want one of them, such that a minimal line cover involves the first rows, the first R rows, so that's defining R, and the last S columns. So, I have, what does this without loss of generality do? Simply, I pick a line cover, and now I'm permuting my rows that all line rows move to the top, and I permute the columns so that all line columns move to the end. And clearly I can do that. And what would be the size of that cover? The size of the cover is, would be of course R plus S, right? Because I have R rows and S columns in the cover. Okay, so and that was the size of the cover, and Q was the minimum size of the cover, so this must be at least as large as Q. Right. So, what I now want to do is, I want to find an independent set of size R plus S. Okay. And not just arbitrary of R of size R plus S, but I want to find an independent set with R entries in the first R rows and S entries in the last S columns. Okay. And I want it not just in the first R rows, but I want that they are in some way separate. So I want to have these end columns, one up to n minus s. So I'm not in the first R rows, but not in the last S columns. And similarly, S entries in the last S columns, but not in the first R rows. So it's in rows R plus 1 up to M. So, just to... So where are we with our matrix? We have the cover here, and we want to find the independent set here and here. Okay. So, okay, so I need to find these entries. And I will first find them here, and then I will use the same strategy to find them there. So, let Ni, do I want, yeah, so let Ni be the set of those column indices such that Aij is equal to 1. So this would be from I goes from 1 up to R. So I do the same idea as before. Birkhoff's theorem, I take a set of entries which give me the column indices of non-zero entries in the first R rows. So what I claim is that these sets and I satisfy the whole condition. Okay, why is this the case? Well, let's suppose they would not. Let's suppose I had the union of K of these Ni's. If the union of K of the Ni's has size less than K, well, then the entries in these K rows have non-zero entries. In these K rows, the non-zero entries are in strictly less than K columns. Well, that means I could remove these K rows from the set of lines in the cover and replace them with K minus 1 columns, and still cover everything what had to be covered in these rows. Right? These rows, because I have these lines here in the, anyhow, the last S columns are covered anyhow. So I only need these rows to cover the bits here. If K of these rows had entries in less than K of the columns, I could replace these rows in the cover by less than k columns and thereby have a cover of smaller size. Then I could replace rows by less than k columns in the cover, and that would contradict the fact that I have a minimum cover. Okay, so because the cover is minimal size, I know any k rows amongst each other must involve at least k columns. And that's the Hall condition for these sets Ni. So, by Hall... by Hall, I get a system of distinct representatives. And that, do you mind? It's two more minutes and I'll be done. So I get a system of distinct representatives here. I do the same thing here for the columns. Ditto a system of distinct representatives for the last S columns. Right? But what does system of distinct representatives mean? This means for every row I have a column index, and it's a column index of a non-zero entry. Well, so this means these are independent entries, right? No two are in the same row, no two are in the same column. So I get R independent entries here. I get similarly S independent entries here because they are in the two different quadrants of this matrix. Together they must be independent. Right? Because no, they cannot share a row or column index because they have chosen separately. So I get an independent set of size R plus S. And that is the independent set I wanted to find. And that proves this theorem. Thank you very much. Sorry for running over. And I'll see you on Wednesday.